From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest from Kiev, the search for the missing Malaysian passenger plane. African asylum seekers are in limbo at an Israeli detention center, plus birth control concerns on the U.S. High Court agenda. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. We begin our reporting on Ukraine with news that the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, has begun a monitoring mission to the country. The 100 observers will gather information on security and human rights in Ukraine, but Moscow is so far from refusing access to Crimea. VOA's Daniel Scherf reporting now from Kiev.
Scores of OSCE observers on Tuesday began officially fanning out across southern and eastern Ukraine after Russia reluctantly agreed. The special mission of 100 civilian monitors will for 6 months gather information on security and human rights in Ukraine, and the mission could be increased to as many as 500 personnel. They will also try to facilitate dialogue after months of political unrest and military tensions over Russia's annexing Crimea. Many fear Moscow may take further military action in regions where vocal pro-Russia populations are demanding that they too be allowed to become part of Russia. Polish Ambassador Adam Kobierowski is the director of the OSCE's Conflict Prevention Center and acting chief of the mission. He spoke Tuesday at the Ukraine Crisis Media Center.
In simple terms, this is monitoring mission. We're sending those people to monitor the situation and to report about what they see, to establish fundamental facts, to try to have as clear a picture as possible, and then from that moment on to try to contribute to the escalation of tension and stabilization of situation here.
Moscow only agreed to the observer mission on Friday after signing legislation for Crimea to become part of the Russian Federation. Moscow says Crimea was annexed to protect its majority Russian-speaking population from persecution by Ukrainian nationalists in Kiev's interim government. Though little evidence has emerged of such abuse, Kobierowski says the monitoring mission includes, as part of its mandate, the rights of national minorities. The United States and its European allies condemned Russia's actions and denounced a Moscow-backed referendum in Crimea as a sham. The referendum did not offer the status quo as a choice and showed 97% of voters wanting the peninsula to become part of Russia. Russia refused to allow monitors in Crimea, arguing it is no longer part of Ukraine. Ukraine invited OSCE military experts to Crimea, but they were turned away four times by pro-Russia gunmen who on one occasion fired warning shots. Russian troops and local militias in recent days stormed Ukrainian military bases in Crimea that refused to surrender or join Russia. Ukraine's defense chief resigned Tuesday after he was criticized for failing to give clear orders to the military holdouts. Moscow's actions in Crimea sparked the worst east-west tensions in decades and tit-for-tat sanctions that have already cost Russia's economy tens of billions of dollars. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Kiev.
And we'll stay in Kiev for this next report. VOA's Steve Herman tells us that the first president of Ukraine, in an exclusive interview with VOA, is warning if Russia invades the mainland of his country, it could be the start of World War III.
The man who served as independent Ukraine's first leader is warning that war will spread far beyond his country if Russian troops move across the border. Leonid Kravchuk, speaking with VOA News in the Ukrainian capital, says he still hopes international pressure can prevent further aggression after Russia took control of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Kravchuk says Russian President Vladimir Putin will not be satisfied only with Ukraine. That will not be the stopping point, and this can be the beginning of the Third World War. While Russia denies plans for further military action in Ukraine, it has moved troops to the border between the two countries for what Moscow says are exercises. Some Ukrainians and security analysts have expressed concern that Russia might try to take control of parts of Ukraine or nearby Moldova, where there are sizable ethnic Russian populations. Some people here and abroad have questioned that if Kravchuk, as president 2 decades ago, had not agreed to send to Russia the 1,800 nuclear warheads it inherited after the breakup of the Soviet Union, Ukraine would not now be facing a possible war with its former ally.
Я був і залишаюся прихильником того, щоб ядерної зброї не було.
Kravchuk says he has stood for and still stands for nuclear weapons not existing at all. And that is why he signed the 1994 agreement in Moscow with then-Russian President Boris Yeltsin and U.S. President Bill Clinton to remove all nuclear weapons from Ukraine. In exchange for relinquishing what at the time was the world's third-largest nuclear arsenal, Ukraine, in the subsequent Budapest Memorandum, received guarantees of its sovereignty from both Russia and Western powers. Russia's annexation of Crimea, following a flash referendum amid political turmoil here in Kiev, violates that agreement according to the U.S. and the European Union. Kravchuk, president from 1991 to 1994, is calling for the West to impose tougher sanctions because of Russia's actions and the military threat it poses. Otherwise, he says, Russia could cross the line and the consequences will be dangerous not only for Ukraine, but also for the world. Kravchuk, a top Communist Party official in Ukraine until the dissolution of the Soviet Union, has especially bitter words to describe President Putin, whom he remembers as a KGB officer who carried the briefcase of others.
Putin працював в службі безпеки, КГБ.
Kravchuk says Putin absorbed the worst methods of the KGB, which, he contends, was responsible for repression and everything else atrocious that happened in the Soviet Union. Kravchuk says the world should remember that Mr. Putin was raised in the organization. Kravchuk, now honorary chairman of Ukraine's Friendship Association with China, says he understands Beijing's abstention on the UN Security Council vote declaring the pro-Russian referendum in Crimea as invalid. He says China's decision not to cast a veto alongside Russia, its traditional ally, was actually a small victory for Ukraine. Kravchuk notes China shares a long border with Russia and desires to get along with a neighbor who is becoming increasingly aggressive, a situation, he says, with which Ukrainians can certainly empathize. Steve Herman, VOA News, Kiev.
What's happening in Ukraine dominated talks at the nuclear summit in The Hague on Tuesday, and President Obama, who attended that meeting, said he's concerned that Russia may be poised to encroach farther into Ukraine and is warning that such a decision will bring further economic sanctions. VOA's Luis Ramirez has our report.
President Obama's warning came at the end of a nuclear summit where the Ukraine crisis overshadowed discussions about preventing nuclear terrorism. At a press conference after the summit, Mr. Obama told reporters he is concerned about reports that Russia is massing troops along the Ukrainian border. He said those troops have a right to be on their own soil, but warned they should go no further. Russia is showing no signs of pulling its forces from Ukraine's Crimea region, and Ukrainian troops have withdrawn from installations there. President Obama said he does not believe the world's recognition of Crimea as a part of Russia is a done deal, but indicated it is clear that Moscow has taken over.
Obviously, the facts on the ground are that the Russian military controls Crimea. There are a number of individuals inside of Crimea that are supportive of that process. There's no expectation that they will be dislodged by force.
Using military force to remove Russia is not an option that Mr. Obama and U.S. partners have discussed here. President Obama has instead concentrated on sending Russia the message that further action against Ukraine or any other nation in the region will result in more costs in the form of tougher sanctions.
You know, I think it would be dishonest to suggest that there's a simple solution to resolving what has already taken place in Crimea.
There were a number of meetings on the sidelines in which President Obama worked to isolate Russia for its moves to annex Crimea. Among his successes, an emergency gathering he called of the G7 leaders of industrialized democracies ended with a group suspending Russia and canceling a meeting that had been scheduled in the Russian Black Sea resort of Sochi. The meeting will now be held in June without Russia in Brussels. That is where President Obama headed late Tuesday for meetings with EU and NATO officials. At NATO, Mr. Obama will reassure allies of U.S. support and urge members to provide assistance to Ukraine's government. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, The Hague.
And a bit more on the 53-nation nuclear security summit in the Netherlands. President Obama on Tuesday agreed to host the next summit that will be here in the United States in 2016. During the closing session, he noted this year's summit was significant for what was accomplished.
Belgium and Italy completing the removal of their excess supplies of highly enriched uranium and plutonium so that those supplies can be eliminated. In a major commitment, Japan announced that it will work with the United States to eliminate hundreds of kilograms of weapons-usable nuclear material from one of their experimental reactors, which would be enough for a dozen nuclear weapons. Dozens of other nations have agreed to take specific steps towards improving nuclear security in their own countries and to support global efforts. So what's been valuable about this summit is that it has not just been talk, it has been action.
Earlier on Tuesday, it was announced that 35 countries at the summit pledged to turn international nuclear security guidelines into national laws. The initiative, pushed by the Netherlands, the United States, and South Korea, also requires participating nations to open their security procedures to independent review.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Malaysia's acting transport minister Hishamuddin Hussein Tuesday spoke with reporters about the latest in the search for that missing Malaysian Airlines plane.
Six Chinese ships are currently in the search area. They are expected to arrive within the vicinity of MH370, last known position, by tomorrow morning. This ship includes the icebreaker Zulong. HMAS Success is also currently in the search area. The American towed Pinger locator, an instrument that can help find a black box, is currently en route to Perth and will arrive tomorrow. The system will be fitted into the Australian ship Ocean Shield, which is due to dock in Perth on the 28th of March.
Several countries have begun moving specialized equipment into the area to prepare for a search for the plane and its black boxes, the common name for the cockpit voice and data recorders needed to help determine what happened to the jetliner. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 lost contact with air traffic controllers about an hour into the flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing on March 8th. Angry relatives of the passengers protested in front of the Malaysian embassy in Beijing on Tuesday. Two-thirds of the 239 people on board the plane were from China, and many of their family members say they will not believe the Malaysian government's conclusions until officials provide proof. Malaysia Airlines is making initial $5,000 payments to the relatives. Malaysian officials provided more details on Tuesday about how they determined that flight had crashed. Hishamuddin explained the judgment was made using a highly technical analysis of automated signals sent from the jet to a satellite belonging to Inmarsat, a British company. The signals continued for several hours after the plane's other communication systems mysteriously stopped working, providing investigators with a rough location of where the jet flew. Also in the news, a leader of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood went on trial Tuesday, a day after the mass death sentences for more than 500 Brotherhood supporters shocked legal and rights groups around the world. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from Cairo.
In Egypt, another day, another trial. On Tuesday, Mohammed Badia, the Muslim Brotherhood spiritual guide here during his arrest last year, is one of nearly 700 Brotherhood supporters charged with murder and sabotage. The trial, at which many defendants, including Badia, did not appear, is in the same Minyu region court that Monday sentenced more than 500 others to death. That verdict for the death of one policeman and other violence, rendered on the second day of the trial, unleashed condemnation locally, internationally, even from anti-Brotherhood members of Egypt's judiciary.
We believe the trial's fairness, which is a right enshrined in the criminal code, was absent in the case, and therefore we take this stand, not in favor of any party. We are all aware and in agreement about the crimes committed by the Muslim Brotherhood. However, we must defend the rule of law in Egypt and ensure justice for all.
In Cairo, where support remains strong for the crackdown against supporters of ousted president and Brotherhood figure Mohamed Morsi, many were pleased with the decision.
This is good, because it is the first time we see our judges act so quickly, because this was the second session.
But such swift action against Morsi supporters, compared to the dragged-out cases of pre-revolutionary officials, left others angry.
So why hasn't Mubarak been given the death penalty? Why hasn't al-Adli been given the death penalty?
With the mass trials and harsh sentences handed down to Morsi supporters being called the revenge of Egypt's military-backed leaders, worries of a greater backlash grow. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
The Israeli Supreme Court is due to begin hearings next month on a controversial law that has allowed the government to detain thousands of African migrants who are seeking political asylum. The migrants, mostly from Sudan and Eritrea, say they fled repression in their home countries, but the Israeli government says they are merely looking for work. VOA's Scott Bob visited the detention center at Holot near Israel's border with Egypt and has our report.
Late morning at Holot. Residents are passing the time outside, among them Nuruddin Ismail. He fled his home in Darfur, Sudan, 10 years ago after government troops destroyed his village and arrested him. He was 16.
They target me as I belong to the rebels. Okay, I arrested two times. That's why I can't live in normal life like anyone else, and I left my country.
Ismail spent 4 years in Chad and Libya before crossing Egypt's Sinai Desert into Israel. Many refugees have been killed trying to cross. Israel allows those who make it to stay while they apply for political asylum. More than 50,000 migrants have arrived in Israel in the past 7 years, causing resentment among some Israelis. The government wants them to leave, says Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
We are also determined to remove from here those who succeeded in entering before we closed the border. I want to make it clear, these are not refugees. We are talking about illegal workers infiltrating, and we are determined to bring them to justice.
The number of residents at Holot, now 1,200, has doubled each month since the facility opened 4 months ago. Visitors and the media are not allowed. Residents may leave during the day, but they must report back 3 times during the course of the day, says Emmanuel Abraha, who fled Eritrea 5 years ago after deserting from the army.
Holot is not a prison, but it's certainly not an open facility. There is no trial, but there's no hope you'll be released. It feels like life imprisonment.
The Israeli government has offered the migrants $3,500 and a free ticket if they leave. Ismail says if he goes back to Sudan, he will be suspected of being an Israeli spy.
Yeah, in this question, I only have two choices. Or I stay here forever, or I go back to my country and get killed.
The residents can visit Beersheba, 1 hour away, but they must be back by nightfall or face time in the prison across the road. The government says more than 2,000 migrants have accepted the return offer, but many have turned it down. They say their only hope is asylum, although they know only a handful have received it. Scott Bob, VOA News, Holot, Southern Israel.
United Nations is facing massive funding shortfalls as it tries to feed millions of people in need in Sudan and South Sudan. VOA's Margaret Bashir reports that without urgently needed funds, people may die.
The head of operations for the UN's humanitarian division, John Ging, said Tuesday that the agency has requested nearly $2.3 billion in funding for humanitarian efforts this year in Sudan, its Darfur region, and South Sudan. More than 2 million people are displaced in Darfur, and over 6 million need humanitarian assistance across Sudan. In South Sudan, recent violence has internally displaced some 700,000 people and forced nearly a quarter of a million others to flee to neighboring countries as refugees. The UN says almost 5 million people in South Sudan are in urgent need of basic humanitarian assistance. Ging told reporters that the appeals are dangerously underfunded.
In that gap between what we receive and what we need are people dying. It's as graphic and as tragic as that.
Of the $995 million request for Sudan, only 3%, or $34 million, has been received. On South Sudan, only a quarter of the nearly $1.3 billion requested has been funded. Ging recently traveled to the region with UNICEF's Deputy Director of Emergency Operations, Yasmin Haq, and the emergency directors of several other UN agencies and NGO partners. South Sudan has less than 1,000 kilometers of paved roads. Yasmin Haq stressed that during the rainy season, which will begin in June, dirt roads will become impassable, making up to three-quarters of the country inaccessible. Normally, aid agencies position supplies during the dry season so they can distribute them during the wet months. But Haq said that has not been possible this year due to the fighting, access issues, and funding constraints.
This means that not enough food has been prepositioned throughout the country. We don't have the type of water and sanitation supplies, nutritional supplements that are so needed to treat the cases of malnutrition, seeds and tools, agricultural implements, whatever is needed to keep a group of people who are in a dire need from slipping further into grave humanitarian consequences is not possible.
In addition to insufficient funding, Ging said in South Sudan, humanitarian workers face delays at checkpoints, slowing down the delivery of aid to those in need. In Sudan, meanwhile, there are regions of the country humanitarians have not had access to in several years, including in the rebel-held areas of South Kordofan and Blue Nile states, where some 800,000 people are in need. Ging said in Darfur there has been better access, except in the Jebel Mara area, where they have had no access since 2010. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether the owners of private companies should be allowed to use deeply held religious beliefs against abortion to avoid a government mandate to provide health insurance for their workers that includes contraceptives at no extra cost. The country's highest court took up the issue on Tuesday. Don Wharton is a pro-choice advocate who was demonstrating in front of the U.S. High Court on Tuesday.
Certainly a corporation per se has no religious beliefs, and it is just absolute and complete bigotry to imagine that they would have the right to propagate their religious views on health care to anyone else.
Jean Ann Maxson is the vice president of Americans United for Life.
Well, we believe that real health care should respect life. And what this case is really about is forcing business owners who have sincerely held beliefs that life begins at conception to fund abortion-causing drugs against their will. And that's against the American dream. It's against all the principles of freedom of conscience and freedom of liberty and freedom of religion that we hold so dearly in this country.
The case before the Supreme Court involves two companies, a chain of hobby stores and a furniture maker. Their owners claim the government's edict that workers' insurance includes some types of birth control would violate their religious views. In the U.S., the freedom to practice one's religion is guaranteed by the country's constitution, but the question in dispute here is whether that guarantee extends to corporations, not just individuals. And President Obama said on Tuesday that he intends to ask Congress to end the bulk collection of Americans' phone records. Instead, the government would ask phone companies to search their records for possible links to terrorism. Privacy advocates were outraged to learn that the government was holding on to phone records for up to 5 years. Mr. Obama promised that he would make those changes. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. It's good to have you with us. You know, you can always find us on the Internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zubair Altayeb, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On March 26, 1169, the military and political leader known as Saladin gave up wine drinking and frivolity to become the Emir of Egypt. Saladin founded a dynasty that ruled much of the Middle East during the 12th and 13th centuries. On this day in 1812, an earthquake destroyed most of the city of Caracas, Venezuela, killing some 20,000 inhabitants. In 1827, one of music's greatest composers, Ludwig van Beethoven, died. An accomplished violin and piano player, as well as a conductor, Beethoven composed chamber music, two masses, an opera, and nine symphonies. In 1830, the Book of Mormon was first published in Palmyra, New York. The book is considered scriptural by the Utah-based Church of the Latter-day Saints. In 1872, one of the strongest earthquakes in U.S. history, measuring about 7.8 on the Richter scale, heavily damaged the Central California community of Lone Pine, killing nearly 30 residents. Two major American literary figures have birthdays today. American poet Robert Frost was born in 1874. On this day in 1911, American playwright Tennessee Williams was born. In 1917, the first of three battles was fought between Allied forces and German-led Turkish troops in and around the Palestinian city of Gaza. After pushing the Turks out of the Sinai Peninsula, the British would not be victorious in Palestine until later in the year when they captured Jerusalem. In 1953, Dr. Jonas Salk announced a vaccine to prevent the paralyzing virus known as polio. In 1971, Bangladesh, formerly East Pakistan, declared its independence from Pakistan. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Two human rights activists recently arrested by Sri Lankan authorities have been released. Father Praveen Mahesan, a Catholic priest and director of the Center for Peace and Reconciliation, and Ruki Fernando of the Inform Human Rights Documentation Center, were detained March 16th. Police said they were arrested for trying to create communal disharmony. Both men had been working with families of individuals who had disappeared during the decades-long civil war between the government and separatist Tamil Tigers. The war ended in 2009 with the defeat of the Tamil Tigers. The Sri Lankan government has been accused of responsibility for the deaths of large numbers of civilians in the final months of the conflict and for not taking adequate steps to ensure reconciliation, justice, and accountability since the war ended. The recent arrests were widely condemned by human rights monitors and governments, including the United States, which issued a statement saying, "It is disturbing that the government of Sri Lanka has taken punitive measures against its own brave citizens who have devoted their careers and lives to investigating alleged human rights abuses by both sides during Sri Lanka's long and brutal civil conflict. These detentions and the continued harassment of those who support the quest for reconciliation and accountability send a chilling effect across Sri Lanka's vibrant civil society and undermine Sri Lanka's proud democratic traditions." In its latest human rights report on Sri Lanka, the U.S. State Department noted several major human rights problems, including attacks on and harassment of civil society activists, journalists, and persons viewed as sympathizers of the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam terrorist organization by individuals allegedly tied to the government, involuntary disappearances, and a lack of accountability for thousands who disappeared in previous years, and widespread impunity for a broad range of human rights abuses. The United Nations Human Rights Council is currently considering a draft resolution sponsored by the United States and other countries calling for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to lead an investigation into rights violations in Sri Lanka. In its recent statement over the detention of Sri Lankan human rights defenders, the U.S. Embassy said, "Both previous and ongoing human rights concerns have led many in the international community to push for a UN Human Rights Council resolution on the situation in Sri Lanka. With these latest actions, we remain convinced that continued scrutiny by the Human Rights Council is necessary."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.